Scott Fischer's sister, Lisa Fischer Luckenbach, wrote, "Based on your written word, you certainly seem now to have the uncanny ability to know precisely what was going on in the minds and hearts of every individual on the expedition. Now that you are home, alive, and well, you have judged the judgments of others, analyzed their intentions, behaviors, personalities, and motivations. You have commented on what should have been done by the leaders, the Sherpas, the clients, and have made arrogant accusations of their wrongdoing. All according to John Krakauer, who after sensing the doom brewing, scrambled back to his tent for his own safety and survival. Perhaps catch a glimpse of what you are doing by seeming to know everything. You have already been wrong with your speculation of what happened to Andy Harris, causing much grief and anguish to his family and friends. And now you have repudiated the character of Lobsang with your tattletale accounts of him. What I am reading is your own ego frantically struggling to make sense out of what happened. No amount of your analyzing, criticizing, judging, or hypothesizing will bring the peace you are looking for. There are no answers. No one is at fault. No one is to blame. Everyone was doing their best at the given time under the given circumstances. No one intended harm for one another. No one wanted to die." This latter missive was especially upsetting because I received it soon after learning that the list of victims had grown to include Lobsang Jangbu. In August, after the retreat of the monsoon from the high Himalaya, Lobsang had returned to Everest to guide a Japanese client up the South Col and Southeast Ridge Route. On September 25th, as they were ascending from Camp 3 to Camp 4 to launch their summit assault, a slab avalanche engulfed Lobsang, another Sherpa, and a French climber just below the Geneva Spur, and swept them down the Lhotse face to their deaths. Lobsang left behind a young wife and a 2-month-old baby in Kathmandu. There has been other bad news as well. On May 17th, after resting for just 2 days at base camp, after coming down from Everest, Anatoly Bukharev climbed alone to the summit of Lhotse. "I am tired," he told me, "but I go for Scott." Continuing his quest to ascend all 14 of the world's 8,000-meter peaks, in September, Bukharev traveled to Tibet and climbed both Cho Oyu and 26,291-foot Shisha Pangma. But in mid-November, during a visit to his home in Kazakhstan, a bus he was riding in crashed. The driver was killed, and Anatoly received severe head injuries, including grave and possibly permanent damage to one of his eyes. On October 14, 1996, the following message was posted on the Internet as part of a South African discussion forum about Everest. "I am a Sherpa orphan. My father was killed in the Khumbu Icefall while load ferrying for an expedition in the late 60s. My mother died just below Faraday when her heart gave out under the weight of the load she was carrying for another expedition in 1970. 3 of my siblings died from various causes. My sister and I were sent to foster homes in Europe and the U.S. I never have gone back to my homeland because I feel it is cursed. My ancestors arrived in the Solo Khumbu region, fleeing from persecution in the lowlands. There they found sanctuary in the shadow of Sagarmathaji, Mother Goddess of the Earth. In return, they were expected to protect that goddess's sanctuary from outsiders. But my people went the other way. They helped outsiders find their way into the sanctuary and violate every limb of her body by standing on top of her, crowing in victory, and dirtying and polluting her bosom. Some of them have had to sacrifice themselves, others escaped through the skin of their teeth, or offered other lives in lieu. So I believe that even the Sherpas are to blame for the tragedy of 1996 on Sagarmatha. I have no regrets of not going back, for I know the people of the area are doomed, and so are those rich, arrogant outsiders who feel they can conquer the world. Remember the Titanic. Even the unsinkable sank. And what are foolish mortals like Weathers, Pittman, Fisher, Lobsang, Tenzing, Messner, Bonington, in the face of the Mother Goddess? As such, I have vowed never to return home and be part of that sacrilege. Everest seems to have poisoned many lives. Relationships have foundered. The wife of one of the victims has been hospitalized for depression. When I last spoke to a certain teammate, his life had been thrown into turmoil. He reported that the strain of coping with the expedition's after effects was threatening to wreck his marriage. He couldn't concentrate at work, he said, and he had received taunts and insults from strangers. Upon her return to Manhattan, Sandy Pittman found that she'd become a lightning rod for a great deal of public anger over what had happened on Everest. Vanity Fair magazine published a withering article about her in its August 1996 issue. A camera crew from the tabloid television program Hard Copy ambushed her outside her apartment. The writer Christopher Buckley used Pittman's high-altitude tribulations as the punchline of a joke on the back page of The New Yorker. By autumn, things had gotten so bad that she confessed tearfully to a friend that her son was being ridiculed and ostracized by classmates at his exclusive private school. The blistering intensity of the collective wrath over Everest, and the fact that so much of that wrath was directed at her, took Pittman completely by surprise and left her reeling. For Neil Beidelman's part, he helped save the lives of 5 clients by guiding them down the mountain, yet he remains haunted by a death he was unable to prevent, of a client who wasn't on his team and thus wasn't even officially his responsibility. I chatted with Beidelman after we'd both reacclimated to our home turf, and he recalled what it felt like to be out on the South Col, huddling with his group in the awful wind, trying desperately to keep everyone alive. As soon as the sky cleared enough to give us an idea where camp was, he recounted, it was like, "Hey, this break in the storm may not last long, so let's go." I was screaming at everyone to get moving, but it became clear that some people didn't have enough strength to walk or even stand. People were crying. I heard someone yell, "Don't let me die here." It was obvious that it was now or never. I tried to get Yasuko on her feet. She grabbed my arm, but she was too weak to get up past her knees. I started walking and dragged her for a step or two. Then her grip loosened, and she fell away. I had to keep going. Somebody had to make it to the tents and get help, or everybody was going to die. Beidelman paused. "But I can't help thinking about Yasuko," he said when he resumed, his voice hushed. "She was so little. I can still feel her fingers sliding across my biceps and then letting go. I never even turned to look back." This concludes the reading of Into Thin Air by John Krakauer. This book was read by Philip Franklin.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.